We welcome in to start the hour, as we do each Tuesday, the talented writer and fine friend of the program, the lovely and talented Colin Fleming. Hello there, Colin.
Hey, Kimball.
What's going on with you today? Causing trouble? Shaking things up?
Yeah, I just got back from my third day to the day, walked 8 miles, and was working on my National Endowment for the Arts grant and writing the definitive short story about a dog and sent out a proposal for a Joy Division book. And guess which one of those things is not true, my friend?
It's
a 3 day. It's, come on, man. Come on. Work with me.
It's just the first one.
Yeah.
That was easy. That was kind of a layup there, but I appreciate you challenging, making sure I'm paying attention here. Let's talk. We got a lot to cover, and we may disagree this afternoon on a thing or two, including this first one. So tell me why you think it might be okay to injure a guy on the ice by lowering your shoulder and driving your shoulder and then his head into the glass. Why is that all right?
I didn't say that.
Okay. All right. So straighten me out.
So if you're talking about, I said something very specifically about injury and the so-called defenseless player and intent to injure. Now, that's a different conversation than what I think you're referring to with the hit on Carlo the other night in the Bruins-Capitals game, which, by the same token, I did not think was particularly egregious.
I watched it. I didn't watch it as it happened. I've watched the replay a number of times. I do think this, and I asked one of our guys who covers the Bruins yesterday and said, if the offending party didn't have a history of this kind of thing, would we be looking at this kind of suspension? And he said, no, reputation obviously plays into it.
I don't think reputation has much to do with it. I think our age has a lot to do with it. As we allege that someone is a headhunter, so are we a collective of headhunters when it comes for looking for transgressions. It was a borderline board. He was not striding when he hit the player, and he rode up the shoulder, and it was a glancing blow. Now, this is the type of hit that would have happened all the time, every shift in years ago in hockey. Not that long ago, in the 90s in hockey, in the 1980s in hockey, and it was what was called at the time getting your bell rung, and that's probably why you're going to see a number of these players when they die. Mark Pavlich recently perished, and of course he was fairly young. I think he was only 63, and a short guy who probably took a lot of hits to the head and had a whole sort of history of mental illness and following. But it's the nature of the sport. You have people moving at 25 miles per hour. But what people try to fall back on in the woke age is this notion of the defenseless player. Like, you're out on some mercy mission, and it's not your intention to hit someone as hard as you can. And I think by definition in life, in anything, when we try to hit someone as hard as we can, which is how the game is played, you are by that definition trying to injure somebody.
I don't know about that. I mean,
it's a buddy pass across the center ice line, and he turns and he doesn't have time to adjust to the player who is going to lay him out. You think that player should, I should ease off. He got a buddy pass from his teammate. Or you try to hit him as hard as you can, a fair hit with the shoulder. But you're not trying to, like, I'll only hit him 80% because he's compromised. That's not how the game is played. You're trying to hit someone, same thing in football. Someone comes across the middle, the pass is behind them, they turn their head, and they're taking one stride to move upfield. That safety tries to knock them into last month. That's just the nature of the game. They don't think, you know what, he's in this vulnerable position, and I should just ease off. Then what's to prevent someone from just putting their head down and making their merry way down the ice? Head down, can't hit me. Of course you lay someone out with their head down. It's the nature of the sport.
I understand that, but no, what I read is when you said, why is it so wrong to try and injure a player?
Because you're trying, it's not. That's not the way the game's played. You're trying to hit someone as hard as you can. That's the definition of, you're not trying to, like, massage them. You're trying to hit them hard. And I don't think we can say, I tried to hit him hard. But my intent was not to, like,
cause him pain or injure him. That's the definition of hitting somebody hard, right? Like, you couldn't say you're at trial and, like, you're in this bar fight and you said, I hit him as hard as I could, but my intention was not to injure him. Like, it just doesn't make sense. It's a contradiction.
Well, here's what I know. And I think that worked, and certainly people play that way decades ago. But being around, like, collegiate athletes these days, I'm not sure that mentality is there today. I don't, and whether that's good or bad can be debated, but I'm not sure everybody plays the game that way or wants to be a part of a sport. Now that we know about, you know, the risk of CTE, the dangers there, I don't know that today's athlete, college or professional, has that same mindset that thinks it's okay to hurt a guy. I'm fine with that.
No, I'm not saying that one enters a game thinking the goal of mine is to hurt somebody. But the nature of the act carries within it the meaning of those words. No football coach, no hockey coach wants a player who is not going to attempt to dispossess another player, the opposition, of the ball or the puck in as forceful a manner, in as legal a manner, too, because you don't want the penalty and you don't want the yards taken away from you, as possible. Bill Belichick's not going to be like, you know what, I'm going to sign the safety because he hits people more gently. It's just not the nature of efficacy within the sport. Now, certain things are legislated a different way within how a sport or a game is officiated. For instance, you used to be able to, and this was not something that could hurt somebody, but on the back check in hockey, so long as you kept your legs moving, you could pretty much do whatever you wanted to do to the offensive player you were pursuing with your stick. You could hack away, you could hook, and it wasn't a hook unless he was actually pulling you. In other words, if you weren't striding. That's just been taken out of the game. Now, if you hit somebody's stick too hard, they can just loosen their grip on it, stick falls to the ice, that's a penalty. Well, you rack up the penalties for ticky-tacky stick fouls, and you're going to go from the second-line winger to the fourth-line winger to the guy who's riding the bench. So I don't think that really speaks to the competitive DNA, which I believe is consistent in athletes over the years. That's more just the way things are legislated now.
Well, let me ask you this about hockey, Colin. I have some thoughts on it. Was hockey better when everybody wasn't out there with a helmet and, you know, armed to the teeth with some of the pads and equipment they have today, when everybody was a bit more vulnerable, was it better?
Now, I don't want to be like some kind of throwback, like Don Cherry, Rock'em Sock'em type of hockey. I would say, and as someone who writes about hockey all the time and talks about hockey all the time and is not of that generation where I was watching the Broad Street Bullies, that was before I was in the world even, I would say that the equipment of the goalies is a major problem. But you have to have that equipment because of the nature of the sticks now. Otherwise, goalies would just be getting hurt. But also, when you have these systems in place, which is the way hockey works right now, especially at the NHL level, it's not the same at the college hockey level, which is more of a flowing game. Women's hockey, men's hockey, all levels, Division I, everything. You see it, Maine, BC, that kind of thing. But the creativity that you would have encountered earlier in hockey is not there right now. It's systems and it's layers and it's the notion of the making the passes as short as possible. The only passes that you see of any length will be the occasional outlet pass, the stretch pass from a defenseman, the few like who actually make that play. McAvoy makes that play more this year than he's done in years past, or across like the box when you're on the power play. But for the most part, passes are like 10 feet kind of passes and chip and chase and self pass. There's not a lot of like manipulation of time and space. And I think the fact that everybody's so much larger and they're faster and we have this legislative eye on the game that, because if you play a certain way and you curl back like Wayne Gretzky would curl back and do that kind of thing to try and create time and space, you are going to get your clock cleaned more regularly than you are now. Then you're going to be out. Because back then, they just stick you back in. It's like, here you go. And I don't know. I sort of feel like that's the risk that comes with the game. And if you don't like that risk and you don't want to be paid millions of dollars to play a child's game, go be a public school teacher.
Hey now. We're talking with Colin Fleming here on Downtown. When it comes to football, is part of the problem the fact that the rules are not even enforced equally, that if you play one position, you're going to be much more safe from the violence that's inherent in the game than if you're playing another position? We protect the guys with the big paychecks in the National Football League.
We protect the quarterbacks in the National Football League, and that's not how it used to be. And it's certainly now, you look at these records for passing and yardage, and you see the stats, like you're trying to determine, say, midseason who the MVP of the league is going to be. There are like 15 quarterbacks that stack up with just these Dan Fouts, early 80s, Dan Marino, 84 type stats that were rare at the time. They're so protected. But I think the nature of football is that you have to turn, as I've said before, I've become less of a football fan as I get older, which is weird because I talk about it and I write about it and all of that. But I think it's like something that you kind of grow beyond in some ways. But the nature of the sport is that you're only going to have these injuries and concussions. And if you're going to police that rigorously across the entire scope of the rosters, you're not going to have a sport. It's almost like something has to give. And our demand for this particular sport means that people's health is going to give, and in a way that's more sizable than with hockey.
Colin Fleming with us on Downtown. You suggest, Colin, that there is hyperbole in social media?
Yes, I think part of the problem with social media and with our world right now is that we've completely lost any ability to, not completely, but it's problematic. We've lost an ability to process nuance and degrees and gradations and satire. Like, there was someone I know who read Meatheads, and they remarked that it was a juvenile book, which is like really a remarkable statement. It wasn't someone who was out to get me. I certainly have people like that. It was someone who couldn't read something and understand that, like, if you encounter the verb finger bang in a novel, that it could be used for non-literal purposes. There could be some other meaning there. And you had this book where there's wine tastings and creative writing classes and Beethoven's late string quartet, and someone's brand of an insult is saying, "Stand down, Robespierre," like the guy who started the French Revolution. So obviously it's like very sophisticated, but someone just could see those words, see how this meathead talked, and couldn't understand that it was set there. It's like Swift. And Swift is like, "Well, we have a food problem. Let's eat the children." People would take something like that literally right now. And I think a lot of it stems from this need we have to differentiate what we are saying. We want it to count more than what other people are also saying on a given subject. But we are so remedial in our language skills, and we're all speaking, a lot of people are anyway, with the same 3 dozen words and the same 2 dozen cliches and phrases, that what ends up happening is people overstrain, differentiate themselves. And that becomes hyperbole. So everyone talks now in this hyperbolic language of just no nuance, no gradation, and we lose everything. As I saw in this pitch that I sent her, this op-ed I wrote the other day, it becomes just one big, giant, mucusy blob.
And how does that then seep into their real lives and causes even further troubles?
Oh, that's a good point, because then that affects our perception. So the way we talk is integral to who we are. The way we communicate, because it's through language that we look at, the language is our eyes. No one thinks about that. But when you are out running your brisk 15 miles in the morning before you go off and educate America's young, and you're thinking in your head, you're not thinking in colors or sounds, even with just yourself. You're having words in your head. That's just, words are our eyeballs. They're how we see the world. So the way we talk then plays this role in how we look at life. And then that's how you get people who have just the most simple takes on everything. How someone looks at something like Meatheads and says, juvenile. Because
They're just someone whose approach to life is speaking in hyperbole. And then the expression becomes the mode of perception.
You talk about the loss of precise language and precise thinking. Is social media largely to blame for that?
It's one of the culprits, the fact that publishing is as corrupt as it is and doesn't put out anything that's worth people reading, and that accrues over time. And that sounds like glacial, like I'm talking like over many decades. Like, no, that can happen fast. That's why I've always thought of myself, or I have at least in recent years, as the remedy, as someone who makes things swing back in a different direction, a leader of sorts with things of this nature, which I think really are integral to culture. But yes, social media, it's not just social media. Social media, even when you're not on social media, it's infiltrating our lives. It's just because everyone we're around is in some ways now, for many people at least, a product of social media. And you're going to be like the people around you. Very few people, we've talked about this in human history, are not going to be to some degree a product of their environment. You create the child, and you don't have to worry about the child learning a language. The child's going to learn its language just by like being in your house, being around you, listening to whatever you say with your spouse and whatever your other kid says and whatever they hear on TV. It's the same thing with everything else in reality. We pick it up from what's around us. There are very few people who say, no, not for me. I will chart my own path.
I remember when we began to see that in education a few years ago when students began writing, even in relatively formal writing assignments, writing in e-speak.
Is that the term for it?
That's my term for it, but using acronyms, short declarative sentences designed to be read quickly and have very little substance.
Right. And the whole idea of reading something very quickly, to me, again, that just seems at cross purposes, because you get these kind of ciphers. And I know that there are people who are entrenched in those ciphers and what they mean and everything, but they're so vague. And I think ultimately more confusion is created rather than when someone takes the time to say something. If we're all using the same, and it's not like a lot of range, how many words do you think the average person uses? I hear it on the radio. I hear everyone speaking the same words and with the same cadences and the same verbal tics and the same you knows all the time. So if we're all working, or most of us are working with like 36 phrases and 400 words, and we're not making a conscious effort to be specific, how much confusion are we pumping into our lives, into our relationships? How many misunderstandings are we facilitating? And it's like, it doesn't have to be that way. It's not clever. It's not a shorthand. It's not a time saver. And for the time people are saving, what are they doing with that time? Did you see that video recently of the teacher? He's like, I don't know what kind of teacher he was, like a history teacher or something, but like high school kids. And he had the kids in the class, and they're talking about like who Hitler was, and someone thought like Hitler was a rapper, but these were like high school kids, and they didn't sound like they couldn't speak, like they were dumb. It was all like a laugh and a giggle to them. I watched that, listened to that. I was terrified by that. They didn't know anything.
I watched that. I don't know where that is. I have high school kids every day in my room, and I have various levels of ability and prior knowledge, and I've seen nothing like that. So I don't know. It may be real.
That's encouraging.
Yeah.
Because you see something like that and you think, oh my goodness. Yeah. I mean, just the idea that you wouldn't know there was someone that they thought was like a rapper. And I think they thought Hitler was a rapper or something like that. And it sounded like a South Park episode that was just, it doesn't take as much as people think to know things. And I was speaking to someone yesterday in my misadventures and would-be love and nothing positive to report.
Sorry.
And so you fill out this form, and like one of the things is like what are you looking for in somebody? And like I answer that the way you'd expect me to answer something. It's like clever and voluminous and all that. And what are your three favorite TV shows? And what are you listening to lately? First question a woman asks me, it's funny because it also says I'm an author. She says, what's your degree in? And I just thought like that's That's what you want to work with here is what's my, who's to say I have a degree? Because I didn't learn more in college than anyone who didn't go to college. All the things that I write about, we talk about, no one taught me any of that. And I know that people are different and I'm different, but everyone can do their version of that. It's funny because I knew she wanted to tell me about her degrees. And one of the things I said I was looking for was Socratic wisdom. So she says to me, this is brilliant. She goes, wouldn't Socrates be the only one who could have Socratic wisdom?
Oh, there you go. So that didn't go too far.
It, I did what I do. I say I have like an exit line. And the reason I have an exit line is so I don't get attacked as much online after. You don't give them any fodder or ammunition. I say, great, comma, good luck. That's what I give you. So if anyone's out there and you're like, oh, I'm going to write this guy, maybe we'll have romance, and you see a great, comma, good luck period, we have reached the end of our time together.
Perhaps they're just looking, Colin, he said with a lovely segue, they're just looking for intelligent discussion in their life.
That's the thing, too. See, I sort of like when I tell you, I say, like, maybe we could talk about this on Tuesday, and then I forget completely what I said. And it's like a surprise. I like that. I don't get a lot of, like, surprises. And yes, when people make this sort of distinction, they say you also have to be able to have an intelligent or intellectual discussions, which is just, it's funny, right? Because I feel like anyone who's ever had an intelligent or intellectual discussion, and that's what we have all the time, right? Like, we don't like, okay, Rich, we're doing an intellectual one this Tuesday. Like, that's not how it works.
Right. Do people get together and say, hey, let's have an absolutely moronic conversation? I would love that.
Well, you know what it means. Anybody on the blog, you know what it means when someone makes that distinction. They think, like, okay, I'm going to knock back some White Claws. And I don't even really understand what White Claws are. Like, they bring up. My understanding is that I could be wrong. Maybe this isn't an intelligent discussion. I think White Claw is kind of like the modern-day version of Zima. I used to enjoy it back in, like, 1995. But whenever I'm at the Golden Goose and I see someone, like, carrying out the White Claw, I'm inclined, well, I should just say it, I don't like that person. I know it's, like, unfounded. Maybe White Claw is brilliant. But it's like having some white wine and just talking out of your ass and telling yourself that you're deep and just kind of like making a spectacle out of yourself, but with someone else who is also knocking back the White Claw and the white wine. And then you've like done your due diligence as a smart person, and then you go back to Netflix.
I want to listen into that conversation, though, to hear where they're going in their journey.
That's just, it's just so weird. And the whole thing where people put stock in degrees, and there's certainly people that we both think well of, Orson Welles and F. Scott Fitzgerald and Bob Dylan. These are not people with degrees now. Like, it would be one thing if you were going to be a doctor, but look, you're going to learn more reading the blog for free right now for 3 days than you're going to learn 4 years at any college in America. So subscribe, people. Follow me on Twitter, too, for my Bruins in-game tweets. So I can get up over 200. But you know what I'm saying. It's just this idea where we have these categories and these expectations and what's your degree in. So if I had said, oh, it's in this and this from Harvard or something, that means something to somebody. It shouldn't mean anything to anybody. Go by what someone is putting out there. Go by what you put yourself out there with whatever you have to offer. And let that be the deciding factor, the idea of merit, not expectation, but reality.
Well, and it's past tense, at least if it's a conversation in college, the what's your major, man, at least that's relevant to that time and place. But what did you study 20 years ago when you were a college student? What bearing does that have on the here and now or the future?
Because people look at things as status and symbol. We move away from quality and reality. And by quality, I mean the quality that something possesses. And you know me, you can imagine what this sort of profile would look like. It's going to look like only I could write it. In other words, I give you plenty of material with which to work, whether you want to talk about the TV shows or what I'm looking for, that kind of thing. I mean, it's not 8,000 words, but at the same time, it could only be from this one person. And then it's just like, okay, if you want to do the whole deductive thing, it says I'm an author. So I either, like, if I did go to college, I probably did something somewhat pertaining to that and was not, like, at taxidermy school, which really would be better for, if you want, if there are people out there who want to be an author, you would be much better off going to taxidermy school than you would be going to an Ivy League school or a creative writing degree for an MFA, or go on a, whatever the current version of a whaling ship is, like Melville. But all of those people, Dickens, Shakespeare, like anyone, like sort of that you respect who wrote really well, they weren't like, I'm a product of the English department. Like that it's amazing to me that like no one who writes, no one in publishing has put this together. If you're any good at writing, you're going to be too good for the university. You're not going to fit in. It's ironic that you mentioned high school, because when I was in high school, I got a lot more out of that in terms of someone who was trying to become a writer and learning about literature than I did when I was in college. College was just the antithesis of any kind of writerly growth.
All right, now I'm curious, what did you list as those favorite television shows?
I change it up sometimes, but I put The Rifleman, I put The Outer Limits, and this is one, I might be able to trip you up with this one, maybe, but a guy like you, you're so astute. The Likely Lads. You know that one?
I don't know that one.
The Likely Lads was in two incarnations. First, it was called just The Likely Lads, and it's the mid-60s. It was a British show about two friends, kind of like Bert and Ernie, who hang out at the pub a lot. And then it became a follow-up to them later in life called Whatever Happened to the Likely Lads, which is also the name of a Libertine song. But it was like this revolutionary humor at the time, because it was not very posh. It was very, like, northern and working class. So if you dug, like, the humor of the Beatles in 1964, you would have dug the humor of these two main guys. But again, it's like the type of thing, it's actually called a prompt on the Facebook dating app. And someone could say, what is that? I mean, there's just a lot to work with. And you just get mindlessness. And the reason I'm even talking to this person in the first place is because it's like, well, the first person all week who spelled half the words correctly. I mean, that's just not a way to go through life. And I'm not like being mean or like condescending. It's just like, damn, we are dumb.
I would say this, if I were a 40-something financial planner graduate of Wellesley with a bad attitude, yeah, I would be intimidated by you in that too. So, but that's good, because you don't want those people.
So I get it. I think that's an age that doesn't work for me, because that's someone who, like, if they're more intelligent than other people, and this is just something I've learned from experience, people tend to be less stable, ironically, because I feel like they've been sort of cut apart from the pack, and that's hard. It's not as hard maybe if you're Beethoven and you have that outlet, but for other people, they can feel like an outcast, and that can take a toll over time. I think really, like, my age for someone is going to be like 28 to 32. And also I need someone who can do some semblance of keeping up. But I'll tell you this is an interesting statistic. If I'm talking to somebody and eventually I can't delay any longer the specifics of what I do, and it's hard to sum up, so I'll just like link them to the site. 100 out of 100 times someone sees that website, I never hear from them again. Or they write me and say, you're too smart for me. I already feel bad about myself. I could never keep up with you. But if they see that website and it takes like 3 minutes, we're done. So they're terrified out of their mind. I mean, it's hard. You know what I'm saying, though?
Yeah, I do.
It's depressing. It doesn't work well for me, because I'm being penalized for, again, this is kind of like the central tenet of my life right now, for virtues. Like, this guy, he doesn't think so. He's going to think I'm dumb. This guy's like some genius guy. I'm not. I'm looking for somebody more like myself, and then they're just terrified. And it makes me feel like an ogre, too. Like, it really does. It gets me down on myself for things that, like, you don't want to wish to be a meathead, but it's like, man, sometimes I think this is tough right now.
Why can't they just read and have a good sense of humor and like hockey and be a regular person?
It's like in science, like attracts like, and we're so insecure right now. And you see it, like, you see the envy that I deal with in publishing. And obviously, that's, like, a huge culprit. But you've seen enough of these emails.
these people are terrified of me. And they're not terrified of me because I'm some draconian monster. It's because of what I can do and what I know and the fact that I'm legit and I'm the athletic-looking guy from Boston and not the person from Yale and the MFA program at Iowa who's running up the stairs and writing the novel in his head as he does so and everything else. They're frightened of me. And when people are frightened of you, they're going to avoid you. You're going to put them kind of on blast in terms of the reality of what they know about themselves on some level, and you bring that knowledge to the top level. And right now, and this is a huge piece of the pie, I don't know how to solve this right now, that's holding me back a lot in everything.
Keep working at it. Better days ahead. I've been telling you that. I'm convinced of it. I believe it. Colin Fleming, check out his latest book, which is about as far from juvenile as you could get. Meatheads Say the Realest Thing, a satirical short novel of the last bro, available everywhere fine books are sold. Visit the website at colinflemminglit.com. Subscribe to the Many Moments More blog. You'll be a better person for it.